speaker, Kate. Kate's also a member of the Sydney branch here, and she is an activist in her union, the Public Service Association. So please make her feel welcome. Let us not flatter ourselves overmuch on account of our human conquest over nature, for each such conquest takes its revenge on us. In 2018, the revenge that Engels wrote of 140 years ago has been severe. We've seen heat waves and fires killing dozens, now hundreds, in Canada, California, and Greece. Flooding rains have wreaked havoc in Japan. New records were set every time I revisited this talk. And I think that everyone in this room will agree that human activity is massively changing our environmental systems. But I do think it's worth reflecting for a few minutes on how severe the situation is becoming. Because temperatures of up to 35 degrees above average have been recorded this Arctic summer, and Arctic ice is melting at huge rates. Reductions in ice and snow mean that the reflective area of Earth's surface shrinks, speeding up warming. This is known as a feedback loop, and they're occurring in a number of Earth's crucial systems. And permafrost, which holds historic carbon stores, is now starting to thaw on a massive scale. And once permafrost starts to thaw, we can't control how much carbon dioxide and methane is released by microbes into the atmosphere. And that release speeds warming, and that warming melts permafrost. It's another feedback loop. Now, climate change is happening faster than any of the scientific models suggest, threatening that dangerous tipping points will be reached far sooner than anyone had predicted. And the great majority of ordinary people want real action on climate change. But for capitalists, they see the melting of Arctic ice and permafrost as a prime opportunity. They want to access new shipping routes and previously inaccessible stores of fossil fuels, precious metals, and rare earths. It's as though multiple disaster movies are converging. The super-rich corporations are just unwilling to pull back from the brink of disaster. Will it be the extreme weather that gets us first, or will it be a rare disease released from by pathogens which had been locked away for hundreds of years in the permafrost? And I think we shouldn't imagine for a moment that the rich are going to experience the disaster that they have created in the same way that we will. Because the super rich are already investing in luxury bunkers that can withstand nuclear war or climate disaster. Like, they're planning to leave the planet, like Elon Musk. They are literally doomsday prepping. But they are continuing the behaviours that are leading us towards potential disaster. And at the core of my talk is really an understanding that the environmental apocalypse is not a universalising question for all of humanity. It's actually a result of and a clear demonstration of the class-divided nature of our society. So Resources Minister, no longer, Matt Canavan, said about the Adani coal mine, "This project will be a net environmental plus for the world." What he really means is a net plus for the profits of the rich. And I'm actually not going to spend heaps of time talking about Adani in this talk, because I hope people might raise it in the discussion. But I feel like there's just so much to say on the question of environmental destruction generally. And when I use that term, I really mean changes in Earth's natural systems, which humans and other species rely on to live. Because I don't think that we can reform this destruction out of capitalism, just like we can't remove war or sexism or racism. And that's because the exploitation of humans and the environment are actually fundamental to the way that capitalism works. That's how the rich make their money. And systemic problems need systemic solutions. Individualized solutions are actually worse than insufficient. They steal all the oxygen in the room. They're a real distraction from the need to develop a collective response. And they also blame the victims rather than the criminals at the top. So, this talk is not intended to be a doom and gloom piece, but it is a call to arms. We can't close our eyes and look away and pretend that things are going to be all right. because the environmental disaster being caused by the capitalist system is immense. But it's also one of the most compelling reasons to fight for a fundamental change in the way that the world is run. So in this talk, I want to do a few things. I want to provide a materialist analysis that actually grounds these dramatic changes that we're witnessing in Earth's systems in capitalism. And I want to analyse why capitalism is fundamentally unsustainable. I want to provide a critique of some of the mainstream solutions, so-called, to the environmental crisis. And I want to make an argument for collective resistance and ultimately for revolution. So let's get started by having a look at the science. Barry Commoner, a pioneer in the Earth systems field, wrote in 1971 that the chief reason for the environmental crisis is a sweeping transformation of productive technology since World War II. And that view isn't necessarily common sense, because the first instinct of most scientists was a likely turning point was when humans started burning coal back in the mid-1700s. But actually, using ice cores from Greenland, we now have a clearer understanding of climate history and CO2 use. And we also, this has actually affirmed Commoner's argument. Homo sapiens, or modern humans, have been on Earth for roughly 200,000 years. And about 12,000 years ago, a period of extremely stable climate conditions began. It was known as the Holocene. 11 different societies on different continents independently developed agriculture early in the Holocene. Basically shows that there was this new opportunity for humans opened up by this reliable climate. And then, around 70 years ago, there was a huge change. These graphs show the 12 Earth systems. There's things like carbon dioxide there, but deforestation, biodiversity loss, a whole range. And the graphs are known as the Great Acceleration. It shows that a new epoch actually commenced between 1945 and 1950. And now 9 of 12 Earth systems have completely left the standards of the Holocene altogether. And a new term was phrased, the Anthropocene, to talk about this new environmental epoch. The author of that term did not blame all humans equally. That's actually something that has been retrofitted to suit the interests of media commentators and big business. But I guess the takeaway from this is that it's during the era of modern capitalism, specifically since World War II, that these huge changes in our environment have been occurring. It's those changes in the way that things are produced that primarily drove the Great Acceleration, and now every Earth system is threatened. All of those systems are important to sustaining life on Earth. It's not just carbon dioxide that's the question. So why is capitalism so destructive? Because humans have actually always impacted the environment, and the environment has always impacted humans. But there's something different about capitalism. We are part of the natural world. We can't live without it. We use natural resources to meet our needs, starting with the most basic of air, water, and food. But the graphs show that there's these massive changes in Earth systems. And they didn't just come with the evolution of humans, but much more recently. For tens of thousands of years, there were two major factors which limited human impacts on Earth systems. Firstly, things were localised. Production was organised by small, independent groups. And while they might cause erosion or pollution or a reduction in biodiversity, there was no globalised system of production and consumption that could affect huge areas. And also, they weren't alienated. What that means is people were working the land, foraging or hunting directly. They received feedback signals on the impacts of their behaviours and could modify them accordingly. And so many pre-class societies, including Aboriginal people, had codes of behaviour and religious beliefs which supported sustainability and a connection with the natural world. It wasn't because of some moral superiority, it's actually a logical upshot from their way of life, their mode of production, in like Marx's shorthand. Now, capitalism, as a global system of production, has the capacity to impact on whole Earth systems across continents and even globally. Monopoly capitalism, with huge corporations like Bayer, Monsanto and ExxonMobil, has impacts across the globe. Like, a single business decision by one of these giants can meaningfully impact the future of humanity in a way that was never previously possible. And the people who make these decisions are focused on profit. They have no connection to the natural world that they are impacting, just as they never meet the workers that they exploit. And by mixing scientific and social data, we now know that continuing along the current trajectory, most of Earth will be uninhabitable within a few generations. Like, this is totally insane. Most of the Earth uninhabitable to human beings within decades. So why, with this evidence of the severity of climate crisis, extreme weather events, pollution, biodiversity loss, why do politicians and business leaders refuse to take substantive action? Well, I think we have to understand what capitalism is, what makes it tick, to really diagnose this problem. First of all, it's a class-divided society. So you've got a society divided into the minority capitalist class, the 1%, who make all the decisions and keep the profits, and then the majority working class, who have no say over the running of the economy, but they do all the work. Secondly, it's a system of commodity production. So everything is made to be sold on a market. Even the absolute necessities like housing and food are made to be sold for a profit. And if it's not profitable, there won't be investment. And thirdly, competition between corporations is key. Each is competing for a bigger slice of the pie, making the system unplanned and crisis prone. This structure makes capitalism wildly inequitable and wasteful. More than 2,000 people will die from starvation during the half hour that this talk takes. And yet masses of food is routinely dumped, burned and even dropped in the ocean. Yeah, I had a slide showing like just mass dumping of food. It's just absolutely criminal in this world where people are starving. And I would argue that capitalism actually can't reorganise itself to address the ecological crisis. It will not change because its fundamental features really mean that profit is king, even if it destroys the habitable environment. 7 of the 10 global corporations with the highest revenue in 2017 are energy or mining companies based on fossil fuels, or car manufacturers. And individual politicians and capitalists are actually trapped within the logic of the system, regardless of their personal opinions. That is not to forgive their inexcusable behaviour, but just to focus our analysis on the underlying dynamic of the system, rather than on individual personalities. So I wanted to turn to some of the green ideologies that focus on idealistic or individualistic solutions to what is actually a structural problem. I want to provide a critique of some of those mainstream solutions, and the first is anti-consumerism. And there's related arguments that sit behind it around individual lifestyle changes and even population control. Now, these solutions are irrelevant at best. They actually make no substantive contribution to challenging environmental destruction. There's no scientific basis for these arguments about population control, but at worst they actually become this green cover for serious racism and hatred of the poor. Probably lots of people have seen this graph, but the reality is, like, production is not done for human need, but actually for profit. So population growth is not the key to determining environmental impact. But I would say there's something wrong with this graph in that it ignores the fact that decisions about production happen at the top, and it's actually the way production is organised that's the key problem. Before any of us can consume a product, the capitalists who invested in it already made all those key decisions about how it's going to be made. Speed-ups and shortcuts and ways to increase profits that routinely hurt workers and the environment are commonplace in the competitive world of business. And we have no visibility or real control over the disgraceful production practices that companies use. The most destructive thing about these arguments is that they have us blaming ourselves or our neighbours and focusing on behaviours which do nothing to address the scale of the crisis that we are facing. But they also distract completely from the real criminals who are responsible for causing the environmental crisis. You know, think back to that slide. Just 100 companies are responsible for 71% of emissions in the last 30 years. The second argument that people make is that technology or increasing efficiency will save us somehow. And I think this is another encouragement to look for salvation in the very system and people who have taken us down the path to destruction. Under capitalism, workers are producing more and more every day, and yet the trend is not to reducing resource use, but rather to reinvest that surplus and produce ever more for the sake of profits. So, will renewables suddenly become profitable and save us? Well, renewables now generate about 12% of global power, up from 5% a decade ago. It's just so utterly insufficient to address the ecological crisis that we're facing. But the dictates of capitalism hold back progress. Like, corporations have $13 trillion or more invested in fossil fuels. They refuse to give this up. And they actually fund dodgy climate science and lobby politicians to protect their investments. A sane response to our current situation would be to stop all new fossil fuel projects and start rapidly phasing out the existing ones. But instead, we have Labor and Liberal politicians helping to facilitate the Adani coal mine and companies turning to unconventional fossil fuel extraction, like gas fracking or tar sands mining. In the US alone, $20 billion in subsidies annually go to the fossil fuel industry. And globally, indirect subsidies are thought to be over $5 trillion a year, when you include healthcare costs, military costs to secure shipping routes and things like that. We don't live in a world where there's an even playing field, where the best science and technology rises to the top. Everything is distorted to serve the profit motive. Companies in competition against each other won't get off this treadmill of production and consumption. Rather than making better quality products using advances in technology, corporations make products to break, to encourage repeat purchase. It's called planned obsolescence. And technical solutions, I think, under capitalism, can't actually solve our problem. For example, 40% of the corn produced in the United States goes to biofuels. This has huge impacts on food markets and land use. And even the alternatives to plastics that are being discussed are likely to cause major issues, like plant-based options, involve deforestation, monoculture plantings, pesticide use and so on. Other options involve mining huge amounts of minerals. Under capitalism, there is no solution because profitability is key. And Engels' revenge that he speaks about is relevant again and again. I guess to think that technology is our solution is just to stick our heads in the sand because things are getting worse, not better. Two degrees of warming used to be considered the threshold of catastrophe, with tens of millions of climate refugees forced from their homes. And now 2 degrees under the Paris Climate Accords is our goal. Experts give us only slim odds of hitting that, and people like him are trying to work against that possibility at all. And as in many things, Trump is setting new lows in the environmental space. He is an avid climate denier in the most powerful position in the world. But then you have lovely folk like Justin Trudeau, Canada's Prime Minister. He's a progressive when it comes to climate change. You know, he just named an ambassador for climate change. He makes valiant speeches. All the while, he bankrolls new oil pipelines and facilitates things like this, the Alberta tar sands. What a guy. I guess my argument is that there is no one coming to save us from the top. And I want to use an example to explain some of these processes, talking about waste. Because it's really, really common now to hear critiques of consumerism. But I want to drill down a little bit deeper because into what is actually the cause of this. So you've probably all seen like the outcry about plastic waste. There's a whole bunch of it now available like in popular culture, on the news, outrage about people using straws, those kind of things. You know, we've got massive vortexes of trash floating in the ocean. It is now coming into our food supplies. Thank you. But how the fuck did things get this bad? Well, most familiar plastics, like polystyrene, polyester, PVC, they were developed in the 1920s and 1930s. But what really drove the industry's growth was the war industry of World War II. Plastics were used in everything from military vehicles to radar installation. And petrochemicals companies built big factories to turn crude oil into plastic by the lorry load. With the end of the war in 1945, the industry faced a huge glut. And capitalists don't just let their capital investment go to waste. They expect a return on investments, even destructive ones. And so to keep production running, they turned their attention to the mass consumer goods market, with new products such as Tupperware launched in 1948. And that's why this graph looks the way that it does. They developed plastics technology onwards and upwards, and in the early 1980s, plastic grocery bags were introduced. Now over $500 billion, billion bags per year are produced. And single-use plastics, from drink bottles to takeaway containers, are absolutely everywhere. These corporations have known the risks for decades, but they continue to force their products into new markets and escalate production. You could do a whole talk actually unpacking this history and the social factors driving it, but in every instance, it's not consumer demand driving these processes, but rather corporations taking another opportunity for profit. In developing countries, a lack of safe drinking water and aggressive marketing campaigns have driven growing markets. In developed countries, neoliberalisation, the decline of the union movement, together with the capitalist drive to increase exploitation, have created a more stressed and overworked population, which expands the potential market for these goods. And the industry, media and government have successfully diverted attention away from the production of throwaway plastics to individual consumer behaviour. The solutions that they promote involve cleaning up or recycling products that should never have been made in the first place. Okay, so even though it wasn't consumers who caused the situation, could we just address this problem by convincing masses of people not to buy things? Well, no, because it's actually not personal consumption that even drives the majority of waste production. Municipal solid waste there is waste from individuals and households, but it also counts small businesses and institutions, and it still only makes up 20% of the graph. But focusing on personal consumption completely distracts from the big sources of construction, demolition, commercial and industrial waste. And waste management has actually become this just clusterfuck, yeah. Basically. I mean, nuclear waste is an outrage. Got thousands of tons of mining waste being dumped all over the place. And now you have all these people arguing that waste management is the new boom industry where you can make a whole bunch of money. But the reality is, like, capitalism is just so enormously wasteful just through being unplanned. So enormous amounts of food, clothing, products that could be useful to all kinds of impoverished people are being dumped rather than being given to people who need them. There is literally no way to solve the waste problem within the capitalist system because it can't be dealt with on just a piecemeal basis of one regulation here or there. We have to take control out of the hands of the capitalist whose only motivation is yet more profit to give ourselves a chance of addressing the root problem. Now, if we want to change the system, resistance is going to be key. Because if the mainstream media has anything to do with it, I think we could end up thinking there's not much political popular resistance to the diabolical positions of the ruling class. But actually, popular sentiment is massively in favour of meaningful action on climate change. Like 73% of Australians want an end to coal mining and renewable power. And it's obvious, if we lived in a real democracy, we'd already be going in a different direction. So some kind of elitist idea that workers won't be interested in environmental justice is complete bullshit. Because when a corporation chooses to use toxic chemicals in their production process, who is exposed? The workers. And where do polluting factories get built? In poor neighbourhoods, not the rich ones. You know, some claim that Marxists glorify production and technology as some kind of solution to all problems, but that is actually a distortion created by Stalinism. Stalinist dictatorship skewed the popular view of Marx's ecology. But after workers took control of production in the Russian Revolution, they prioritised protection of the environment and scientific research, as well as advancing human rights. Their resources were sapped by the Civil War and invasion by 14 countries. And yet, despite that material deprivation, the Revolutionary Society massively expanded the areas of national parks. They put massive resources into scientific inquiry. The Stalinist counter-revolution was the absolute opposite. It was anti-scientific, competitive, and it crushed dissent. The dictatorship sacked 3,000 scientists, destroyed laboratories, promoted backwards ideas, and destroyed the ecological progress of the Russian Revolution, just as it destroyed their political progress. And Stalin's regime has nothing in common with real socialism. In contrast, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, writing 150 years ago, considered a serious ecological analysis to be a crucial part of understanding human society. Because humans rely on the environment to meet their needs, and so environmental destruction is actually fundamentally incompatible with indigenous rights, workers' rights, and human rights. The material interests of the great majority of the world's population are aligned with the demand for socialism and a radical transformation of production. But the reason that we focus on the working class specifically is not only do they have the interest in changing the world, but also the power, because we do all the work. We are the producers in society. You can get glimpses of that from Australia's radical past. For example, unionised wharfies disrupted the shipping of yellow cake during the anti-uranium campaign of the 70s. And the Australian Railways Union had a one-day national strike when one of their members was sacked for refusing to transport materials to a uranium mine, and he got his job back. The Builders Labourers Federation protected bushland, heritage buildings and workers' housing from rampant development by putting on green bans. Right now, it's capitalists who determine how things will be produced, but we could run things completely differently under workers' control. And today, people are rising again around the world. In China, communities have been devastated by the environmental impacts of being the centre of world production. The most common work disease is respiratory disease from toxic dust and fumes in factories. And for coal miners, black lung, a disease which is readily preventable. But mine owners in China have prioritised their profits over workers' safety. And that same disease is starting to show a resurgence in Australia today. But as surely as capitalism brings suffering, it brings struggle. Since 2013, the Chinese authorities have officially recorded 712 anti-pollution demonstrations. But the real figures are hidden by the authoritarian government, and some estimates range as high as 50,000 demonstrations in the same five-year period. And it's not just China where physical force is used to prop up the profits of the ruling class, because this reality was on display at Standing Rock in the US, where Native Americans and supporters from around the country gathered to stop the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, which violated treaty rights, destroyed sacred sites, endangered water supplies, just like the Adani mine we'll hear. And over a series of months, the No Dapple protests, as they were known, grew to thousands and thousands, and with a huge camp of protesters working together to peacefully resist this attack. And I think the Standing Rock struggle tells us a lot about the limits to potential change within the capitalist system. This here is a quote from President Obama, who speaks about this spirit of cooperation and mutual respect, working sovereign to sovereign. You know, he just totally understands the Indigenous people and their struggle. This is a photo of what Obama effectively sanctioned, which was the smashing of the Standing Rock protest camp. That involved local cops, sheriffs from neighbouring states, the National Guard, company security guards with guns and dogs, basically like industrial scale weapons. So they did manage to smash that protest camp, and the company behind the pipeline is now free to reap an estimated $1 billion per year in revenue. When so much profit is at stake, standing against oil pipelines and coal mines and polluting industry pits us against the powers that be. And the 1% will not willingly change production to protect the environment at the expense of their profits. And I would say that opting for political moderation, like Obama's, if you can call it that, in the face of this existential threat to Earth's habitability is suicidal. So this raises the question, how can a fighting environment movement be formed and how can we exert power? Well, I see it as having to go hand in hand with a broader radical movement for workers' rights and for the oppressed. Protest, education and direct action all have their place and it's a great place to start, but we need mass disruption of business as usual. We need a revival of radical trade unionism and strikes and occupations, as well as building serious socialist organisation if we really want to undermine the corporate power that preserves the status quo. To be an environmentalist alone is not enough, because we need a politics that challenges all the atrocities in this world and sees the connection between them. The same people who have been driving this system full speed towards environmental destruction are responsible for the wars, racism, poverty, economic crises that devastate people's lives in other ways. The US military is not only the most violent institution in the world, but it's the world's biggest polluter. And military means are used time and time again to extract resources more cheaply and more quickly from developing countries for the profits of the 1%. And because capitalism, with its wars and poverty, destroys people's lives, we're facing the biggest refugee crisis the world has ever seen. It's a humanitarian disaster, and environmental destruction will only increase the number of people who are seeking refuge. And far from overconsumption, most people on Earth suffer from a lack of clean water, of infrastructure, of consumption, food, and so on. The environmental destruction further threatens food and water supplies and destroys infrastructure, and severe weather events hit the poor the hardest. The response of Western so-called elites to potential and actual drought, famine, conflict from climate change ranges from calculated neglect to environmental militarism, like to restrict the flow of refugees from affected regions. I think we have to absolutely reject the anti-human arguments around population control or for racist militarisation of borders if they come in a green disguise or otherwise. They have absolutely no place in our movements. So we can and we should fight for environmental reforms now, to end fossil fuel industries, to stop polluting projects against Adani. But we must demand that the big polluters pay rather than workers who have had no say in their employers' practices. When demanding the closure of mines and power plants, retraining and guaranteed jobs are basic demands that we should integrate into our struggle. And we must go further. We need the politics of revolution, of overthrowing the 1%. We need to dispossess the actual human beings who hoard the wealth that could meet the needs of all of humanity and address the ecological disaster. Because by taking production into our own hands, we could eliminate activities that do not serve human needs. Factory farming, advertising, weapons production, coal and uranium mining could be stopped. We could collectivise so many processes to eliminate waste Things like collective kitchens and laundries would be immediately formed, and we could redistribute produce and materials that currently go to waste because they can't be sold for a profit. We could redistribute labour power to urgently focus on the transition away from fossil fuels and dealing with the toxic legacies of capitalism. To wrap up, I want to read a part of a poem by Drew Dellinger. It's 3:23 in the morning, and I'm awake because my great-great-grandchildren won't let me sleep. My great-great-grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do while the planet was plundered? What did you do when the earth was unravelling? Surely you did something when the seasons started failing, as the mammals, reptiles and birds were all dying. Did you fill the streets with protests when democracy was stolen? What did you do once you knew? So I'd like to close by saying that this is the time. If we want socialism, a world where we can meet human needs in a way that can maintain a habitable planet, where we can reverse some of the damage done, it won't happen by magic. There must be a conscious decision by a mass of people, and we must start taking steps to bring it about today. The stakes are high, and with each passing day, the revenge of the natural world becomes more severe. The reality is that if we fight, we may lose, but if we don't fight, we will lose. The politics of socialism are a politics of hope. To recognise the amazing regenerative capacity of the earth, the potential for human ingenuity when it is collectively organised, and the deeply transformative nature of revolution. We know that disaster is possible, but we refuse to surrender to despair. We have a world to win, and the fight starts now.